All right, welcome to the Dadpreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Oliveira. Now, if you've been listening to the podcast for all these years, or you've been subscribing to our newsletters, or have followed us on YouTube or any channel, then you know that we talk quite a bit about marketing. We talk quite a bit about different channels, such as email, which is why I'm excited for today's guest. We're going to talk to Nicholas Toper. He is the CEO and co-founder of Inbox Booster. It's a platform that uses AI to ensure that emails don't end up in spam. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can do that, but I think with the explosion of AI, I'm going to be really curious to hear what Nicholas and his team are doing, because we are definitely using AI not only for our advantage, but also for our clients' advantages. And I think it goes further than that. If you're listening to this podcast and you're an entrepreneur, you're a small business owner, look, what you want is productivity, number one. So that benefits you, productivity. But the other side of that is that if you are able to produce more in less time, which AI helps you do that, and email helps you connect and engage, then you get to spend more time with your end users, with your customers, with your members. And that's, I think, the beauty of the digital space and the technologies and AI, is that you get to spend more time, not only with your clients, but also with your team. So super excited to have you here, Nicholas. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. And I'm excited to be here too.
All right. So let's, before you were doing email, Inbox Booster, early days, how did you get in technology? Is this something you pursued in college?
No. When I was 18 years old, my dad threw me out of my place, so I had to work. And at that time, I knew how to program computers because I had a computer. I was doing that for fun. But during the internet boom, so it was kind of easy to find a job. But because I was from France, in France, you know, we've got this kind of lifetime employment thing. So it's hard to find a permanent job, but it's easier to, it's not super hard to find freelance jobs. So that's kind of how I got started. So it's totally opportunistic, I would say.
Wow. So that definitely worked out. You know, I think feel like in here, the US, and we were chatting about my home country, Brazil, same thing. You know, you have young people who know exactly what they want to do early on, and then you have others who don't, and then you end up, which is it's an entrepreneurial story that I hear quite a bit, you know, whereas I didn't mean to be in this space, but I am here and I love it and I do a good job with it. So interesting that fast forward now you've been into this area of email, but technology for you, before you were doing anything in email, what kind of technologies or applications did you work with?
I actually mostly was in email because what happened, I was doing websites. Then I had to stop in France because France is a very classist society and I don't have a degree. You're basically condemned to having to have really like kind of a low skill job. So I'm like, oh, I really need a degree. So I went to, I took a night school to where I got my master, and I found a job in email, but really, because I was looking for a job. And at that time, delivery was starting, deliverability problems were starting, and I just got hired. I was working half time. It's always complicated when you work half time because you don't have the same hours as the others. You're kind of, and your hourly pay in this case was more. So there is a bit of tension, but. So I'm not sure I was going to stay, like they might let me go, but I got a stroke of luck. Is one of my teacher at that school actually designed the AOL computer.
That's way back.
That's way back. So he told me how, and this was in France, which was totally unlikely because the guy was doing that from France because he was like super good. So everybody let him do whatever he wanted from wherever he wanted. He was a professor, like a university, like a college professor at the same time. And working for AOL on his free time. So he was like super smart. But because I was just getting started, he was like, oh yeah, this is how this works. This is how you want to make it to this is how you want this thing to work. So, and that guy probably has forgotten me, I guess, but it's been kind of, but he has really helped me because he gave me like, he gave me like 20 minutes to help me and explain how that works. So that's
That is so cool. I mean, you've been at it for a long while. I remember going back to, so before your time, it was, I don't know, 1997, the first time I got my first email account at AOL too, you know, here in the US, they used to give these CD-ROMs at the stores. and you used to have to install it on your hard drive. So yeah, email's been around for quite a while. You know, you said something interesting, Nicholas, that I think is worth us visiting here for those entrepreneurs out there who are hiring, but also for those who are, you know, seeking employment and trying to upskill so that they can do bigger things in their career. You said about the professor that he was so good at what he did that he could basically call his shots, do whatever he wanted, wherever he wanted. I want to touch on that a little bit. You know, in your experience, obviously having been a founder of a company, when you hire talent, so again, this works for both sides of the listeners, those looking for a career, as well as those managing and going, gosh, those millennials, those Gen Z are no good. There's plenty of good people out there. But here's the thing, what you said, when someone is really talented and works really hard and can offer something unique, you're likely to just give them the space, the room for them to go do the greatness, right?
So I've actually hired a lot of really good people in my previous business. They went to work for Google, for Mozilla, for companies like that. And it's and there is a tension here. So first of all, you want to give them the space. Awesome. This is so there is two schools here. Like there is a Google type of school or a Silicon Valley. If you're like really, really good, you can do whatever we want. We'll just pay you and we'll just reassess kind of every year if you've brought value to the organization. This is the problem here is it's creating, at least in the resentment, unless in the US, I would say it's a very meritocratic culture, but in France, people hate that. And I guess in other culture, it depends where you're from. But in, and also you still want to push them because that's also what they're looking for. So you want to give them the space, but at the same time, you need to set challenges so they're kind of happy to grow because that's what they want to do usually. So there is a tension, there is a balance to be found here. Because on the one hand, you want to give them a lot more space and a lot more advantages that they can have, like more freedom, more autonomy. Mm-hmm. Usually that's what they want. But on the other hand, you need to challenge them. Because if you don't do that, they will leave.
Yeah, and I do think what you just said there is so true that, you know, inherently there are people whose just natural behavior is to say, look, I need you to give me the play-by-play, the next 3 months work of the project, the timeline, the scope of work, and let me go do it exactly step by step. And then you have people like, probably sounds like the way you are, the way I am, and many of the entrepreneurs who listen to our show here, who like, hey, I just need room to be creative and grow and create. But I think you're right. But I think even here in the US and around the world, my experience has been is that aside from like set aside the culture, there's just those two groups of people. People who either want that room to be creative and don't need direction. And then people who are like, yes, just give me direction or you're going to make me crazy. Because I've had those employees too, where I made the mistake of giving them room and they're like, oh my God, no, give me structure.
But like, so first of all, the thing also I've seen is that there are people who think they're in the wrong category and that creates problems too. Either they will need the creative room.
Big egos.
Yeah, for instance, or vice versa, meaning like, I remember I tried to hire a guy who was at Google at that time, and he was like, okay, pay me 1 year, don't ask me for anything, and in a year, I'll come back, and I'll have lots of things for you. And I was like, yeah, I'm looking to pay you your Google salary for a year without overseeing and without even knowing what you're working on. So that's kind of what you, so that's a little bit extreme. And of course, the interview will go really far, much more forward after that. But that's kind of one of the crazy things you'll see. And the other thing, so you kind of want to, without the big ego thing, that's very true, the word you mentioned. That's why I was thinking about that. But also those people that are creative, if they're working with you, usually they can work somewhat on their own. They can be a consultant, they can build a company. So why do they choose to work in a company? Sometimes for your paycheck, okay, good enough. Some other times for another reasons. And so you need to you need to understand that. And what I found is for those people, they want to learn, they want to grow. And so that's actually interesting because those are people, if you give them like challenges and provide them a space to grow, but to grow, it's like you need to not necessarily teach, but you need to give them feedback, you need to be constructive while preserving their freedom. That's mm-hmm. hard. And but if you can do that, then they will stay very long. And it's not even necessarily a monetary compensation issue. It's kind of this type of environment that they can find where they can work. Think about Google at the early days. They were actually not paying a lot. They were paying under market salary. But they were still able to get some of the best people out there. And the reason of that as to why is because they were providing really, really interesting jobs. So in the end, what I do believe about the work is about work is one, what matters is the work, less than the people. People say the other opposite, but a lot of time, a kind of a very interesting job will tend to attract interesting people, and it's easier to start with the job. So have something really, really interesting for them to do. And if you have that, then you can attract a talent, and then everything's possible. And then, as you point out, there are talents, and initially it's junior versus senior also. That's another way to look at it.
Right.
They want to grow. Everybody usually wants to grow. I mean, at least that's the person we're trying to hire. And then you need to provide them the best way to do it. And the way I look at it is more like as a garden, you know, maybe that's a little bit weird, but in a garden, sometimes you need to kind of, I forgot the name, you put a stick in English, but there you put a stick and the plant grows around it. Some other times the plant grows by itself. So I think that's a little bit like that, the analogy. It may be weird, I don't know, but that's kind of what I was, that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
That makes sense. I mean, look, I think, you know, if you look at the nonprofit organization space or NGOs around the world, there are millions of people who work for NGOs in many countries. You know, just in the US alone, there are over 1.2 million nonprofit organizations. People don't go to nonprofit organizations because they want to make a boatload of money, because they don't, right? Or other fields like academia, you know, education, stuff like that. You go into it because you want to make an impact in the world, and you want that feeling of like, hey, I'm making an impact. And I do think that in the world of technology or startups, that is what they provide. Many, they're able to cultivate that culture where you feel like, okay, I'm a part of something, I'm making an impact, therefore I can, you know, maybe work for peanuts and, you know, maybe have some shares down the road, like OpenAI right now. You look at those employees and the valuation of $86 billion, which might be what they're, imagine if you just had like 10 shares and you've been there for 5 years, but not making a lot of money. Now you've made a big impact in the world and you're probably going to have a big payday. Right.
But that also what has changed in the last 20 years with these tech companies is before they were not paid a lot. Like people generally, like I remember, so I worked a lot in France and then I moved to Austria, so next to Germany. And they were, and I remember at that time, there was a project that was led for a company and they were making us work on the weekend and they paid us extra time. And then I talked to my previous boss about it. And he was like, in France, and like, oh, wow, you're paid overtime, but you're lucky enough to have a job you like. I never do that, which kind of the next sentence that I didn't tell him was, yeah, that's why I'm not working for you anymore. But what has changed at that time, at least in France, engineers were not very well treated. And when I created my first business in France, it was so bad that the first months of operation, I was making as much as I would have as an employee.
Okay.
So like, okay, that's actually stupid to take a job because I can just make more by being by making my own hours. And they had like really, really stupid requirements. Like you had to be at work before set this hour, to be dressed a certain way. I mean, this is, well, I could just make more money by staying at home. So like, okay, well, it's done. But now this has changed because those people you mentioned from OpenAI, that's why we moved to the digression. They were... they're actually paid like, I think their package is like $1 million per year in average. So everybody's paid very, very well. So that kind of has changed the dynamic of the tech industry a lot. But there are still people who, one, everybody wants to be well paid. There is nothing wrong with that, obviously. But there are people who, on top of being well paid, they want to grow. And those people at OpenAI, that's what they want. And what you'll see is if you're a startup, you cannot really be part of something or a movement because that's weird. I mean, you're just small companies really die, so it doesn't matter. What you can do is have an interesting job. So for instance, I remember in an interview, the guy from who built Gmail at Google, he said that he wanted to join Google, not because the job was interesting. I mean, because the job was interesting, sorry. Not because of the company, because at that time it was like, yeah, whatever, one of the dozens of companies doing cool things or whatever, like there was nothing special about them. But they were working on Linux. They had Linux clusters and the guy wanted to work there because of that. So that tracks back to part of the movement. But the movement wasn't, in the case of OpenAI, the movement wasn't OpenAI. The movement was, okay, there is this new type of programming from with AI because we have those new chips and all that. People have been exploring it for 30 years. Now this can get somewhere. But OpenAI is one of the companies that you can join. You can join OpenAI, you can join Meta, you can join Google too if you're a good AI scientist. So why would you join OpenAI? And the reason is because you'll have more autonomy, I guess. Or not now, it has changed. But before, nobody would knew that it would get big. And I'm not even sure they would be, the staff was believing that. That's not why they were here. Which is also another problem, by the way, because as the management or as executives of the company, you want to make it big, but your employees, they don't, even if they're going to have the payday when it happens, they're not really necessarily seeing that. So they don't really see the path to that. But that's another problem.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right. Well, let's switch the topic now to email, get back to the email and inbox booster and what you guys do there that can help anybody here listening that sends out email, whether it's small email blast or big email blast. We all want to get more people to open, which then it needs to land in the inbox. And you need to, there's so many things that you need to do between the domain verification and this. And every platform will have their own promise as to, well, look, we can get you more emails in the inbox and open. What differentiates Inbox Booster and how does it work?
So first of all, open rate is unreliable. So you can't really rely on that anymore. This has changed in the last 3 years because Google, they're going to over-report email. Because what happens with Google is, it's based on an image that you download when you receive the email. But when you are sending an email to Gmail, they're going to download the first image when they receive the email so they can display it to their user if you're on Gmail, or mobile Gmail, offline. So it's somewhat working because some providers are able to filter it, but it's not all the time and it's unreliable. Apple, everybody's with an iPhone, they're going to send fake email open. So they will, so you don't know who's really opening or not the email. And Outlook, they're going to not display any images by default. So this is, in other words, this is the mess. And it's very, very hard to, so you can't rely on that for your open rate. It's not like you don't know who's going to open your email anymore. So still see platforms that say, oh, if you have open email, then do this, do that. They don't work because the open is unreliable. Click rate is still valid. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, yes, you want to get to the inbox. And as you pointed out, a lot of companies are trying to do that. But what we do is, they're all saying we have a better infrastructure, our things is better and so on. What my 20 years of experience here and what we found in the field here, because we still have a couple of hundred customers of over 3,000 users, what we found is it doesn't matter in a lot of cases. It's a commodity, like we even have an open source email system. It doesn't matter. What matters, some things matter, but the quality of the MailChimp versus Brevo versus whomever you want, it doesn't matter. It's not going to be, it's really just a UI thing. It will matter if you have problems. It's going to be it's kind of like an electricity provider. If you have the choice of several, it matters because if one is not reliable, it matters. Otherwise, nobody cares. So this is the same type of thing. What we do now is we're not helping you. What we're doing is we're telling you if you're in spam, why you're in spam. And we're the only one to do that. So you can go on inboxbooster.com, you can send your emails, and we'll tell you if it's we'll tell you if you're in spam, first of all, because it's not even easy to figure out, and two, and this is free, and then we'll tell you why. So you can have different reasons, but mostly it boils down into two directions, two buckets. The first one is domain reputation, like reputation issue, like IP or domain. And the second bucket is content issue, or if you like what you call content issue, for instance, going to be a specific word in your subject triggering spam placement and so on. And another way to look at it, and that's actually a more actionable way, is one is something that has nothing to do with you. For instance, you're using a word that's creating the spam placement, so we'll tell you, and you can fix it and you're done. And the other bucket is reputation, which is usually linked to what you've been sending. So not all the time, but most of the time. So we're able to differentiate, and then we'll tell, and then if it's on your side, then like, yeah, you need to improve here and you'll be in inbox. But contrary to everybody else, one, we're telling you precisely through an evidence-based system, because we actually kind of built a proof to know what's happening. So we tell you, yeah, for instance, if you're, if it's a reputation issue, we'll tell you because we'll have sent the same email through another sender whom we know have a good reputation. So we know that it's a problem like that. Then we'll run some statistics to make sure that it's working. So we'll tell you it's a reputation issue. So you'll know that. And then you can take action from that. And that's kind of what matters. Because right now, they're all pretend that they have magical tool to fix problems, mm-hmm. but they're not really competition. They're not really going to tell you what is the problem. They'll guess it, like, oh, it's because you have three in your subject, or it's because you don't have that you're on this blacklist and blah, blah, blah. And so this is what we do instead is we're telling you, okay, for instance, this word, if you remove this word, you're back in the box. So for instance, we had a customer. They had a word tag in there in an image that they put in their email that was creating a phishing alert on for Gmail. I don't know why, we just tell them, remove this tag, you're back in the box. That's kind of it. And so they do, and this was like a sign-up email, so they had no reputation or spam problem. It's really a collateral damage. It had nothing to do with them. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have customers who've been very aggressive with outreach email, for instance, or they never pruned their subscribers from their newsletter. And so this creates a reputation issue. But usually, we talk to them or we point them to one of our blog posts, and then they figure out the cause themselves. And this kind of sweet spot, nobody's doing it because you're going to, you can have consultants who are going to charge like 20K per year to do that. Or they're going to do more of that, or you're going to have a free tool that they're going to say, oh, we think you might have a problem here. What we do is really figuring that problem.
I think it sounds it's interesting because so many channels on the web when it comes to marketing or communication, email falling into both of those categories. So many channels, there are tools for you to do the audit, for you to do an analysis, you know, like for SEO, you can use Ahrefs, you can use SEMrush, there's a lot of tools that can tell you, here's all the things that you're doing wrong, here's how to fix it, go fix it. Email, it's like, for all these years, it's been the more of the focus is like what you said, trying to figure out like, how can I increase my click-through rate, my open rate, how much traffic I get to the website, how many products do I sell? But rarely do you see, unless like what you're saying is bringing in a consultant, rarely do you see applications that can quickly and easily assess. Like the other side of it is subscribers, right? So I use a software called XVerify that scrubs a lot of the data and you can append it. And so there's a lot of focus on the audience subscribers. There's a lot of focus in other areas, but I haven't seen a lot of focus into what you guys are doing. So I think that's amazing because we spend so much time as marketers, as business owners, creating that thoughtful content. Hopefully you're creating thoughtful content. And if it's landing in the spam because of, like you said, a keyword or something to do with your IP location, it's a shame because it's like, it's as if you mailed a piece of direct mail to a house in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that's correct. And also speaking of that, first of all, Ahrefs reference is exactly what we're trying to do. Like in SEO, in the SEO world, you've had consultants, and then there were people who built tools to audit, so small business owners could, or small teams could do it themselves without hiring consultants. That's exactly what we're trying to do. And right now, you have somewhat tools, but what they're doing is they're aggregating free tools from free information. So if you're like Samsung or IBM, you don't waste time by checking your hundreds of domains. You can just have kind of a UI to do it, and they charge like $1,000 per month for that. What we do is really charge a lot because we're really focused towards the SMBs. So our small business owners, that's really what we want to work, or normal people, that's how we call them. And the second idea, so that's a very good analogy. And the second thing about email is it's even hard. It's like SEO now. It's even hard to know if you're in inbox because, for instance, if you type a keyword, Google is smart enough to figure out that, you're the owner of the website. You probably want your website as number one results, but it might not be the case for everybody else. The same with email. The fact that you are an inbox on your email from your own internal test doesn't mean anything. You might be in spam for everybody else because they're super smart. So they're going to figure out who wants to receive that email. what you want to do as the business owner or as an email sender to make sure that by default you're not in spam. And so that's why we're giving away those tests and even a part of the resolution process. So you can test, before you're going to send a newsletter, if you're going to be in inbox or not. And there is something a little bit nasty, by the way, here. Those senders like Brevo, MailChimp, and all, they have no interest to tell you that you're in spam, because the truth is, if you think about email, everybody receives too many emails. So you're not going to receive too many emails.
That's right. Yeah.
You're not going to receive more emails. All those people, they chart by the number of emails sent. So what you're saying is a reputation problem is, yeah, you probably send less email. You probably want to support, for instance, your subscribers if they're not active. So we're telling people to send less emails. So if I was in a position where I was MailChimp, then I would reduce my revenue for that. And this is not something they can do. So
I agree. It's definitely not in their best interest to do that. No, absolutely.
And they're not equipped to do that. Even if not only they're not equipped, they don't have many people to do that, to say that, like, please reduce my revenue. So it's very hard for them to do. But that's what's needed. So that's basically what we're actually, that's why we're here, basically.
Well, I love it, Nicholas. I mean, Inbox Booster, I definitely will be checking it out, because email's been something that I've, like I said, have been promoting, whether you use your own ESP, set up your own, whether you build it with another agency. As a marketer, I have always proposed that you have email in your mix of channels, not only for marketing, but also for communication. And it's something that you have to be very strategic about. This sounds like, to me, Inbox Booster. I'm definitely going to try it out. What's the best way for our listeners to find your offer or try it?
So they just go on inboxbooster.com and they can send, they can test it for free. They can use the tool for free. And if they want, they can book a meeting with me, and we're happy to talk to everybody.
Right. Fantastic, Nicholas. It was so nice having you here on the podcast and learning more about your background. Maybe some episode later, we'll have you back to talk about your battery that you shared. Oh, yeah. That's a very interesting story. And I definitely want to do that on another podcast, because you're one of those entrepreneurs that you have done different things that are not even in the same realm. So we'll definitely have you back again. But thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much.